Father's house.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. You will not believe the story that you're going to hear from my guest today on Church and Culture. Mark Riebling has just published a book entitled Church of Spies, the Pope's Secret War Against Hitler, and that Pope is Pope Pius XII. And Mark is a very well-known expert in intelligence, counterterrorism. His book for Knopf, entitled Wedge, How the Secret War Between the CIA and the FBI Has Endangered National Security, has become a more or less accepted classic on the various issues between the police and espionage agencies. Mark, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I cut short your introduction a little bit. There's a lot more to tell about you, but I'm sure you'll understand that I want to get to this amazing book that you've written. And I'm sure that our listeners realize that over the past 10 years or so, there's been a lot of criticism leveled at Pius XII, and it's basically having to do with his silence on the Jews, on the Shoah, on the Holocaust, which, of course, is a question you raise at the heart of your book. But I must say that as I read your book, and I read it at one sitting, I felt like you were almost rewriting the history of the Catholic Church during the World War II era, in the sense that you were bringing so much new information and untold stories to the narrative that people just haven't heard. Do you think that's fair? I know it's praise, but do you think it's a fair thing to say?
Well, if I didn't think it was fair, I would have kept working on the book and thought it was fair. So, but I would say it, and also by way of perhaps complimenting, even if in a backhanded way, some of those who would disagree with me, I think where my book fits into the overall vast literature on this very controversial pope is I would say that literature that's very critical of the pope is not so much incorrect as very incomplete. Despite a billion words in published English, very, very, very little had been done on the Pope's contacts with the German resistance, certainly nothing at book form, even though some of the fiercest critics, such as John Cornwell, who wrote Hitler's Pope, or Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, James Carroll, the liberal Catholic, Gary Wills, they all admit in a phrase or a sentence or a paragraph that Pius XII hated Hitler and did conspire to remove him. But to me, they showed a dramatic lack of curiosity about what the Pope actually did,
to say the least,
what he did not say. And so I just felt like the better point of fairness is to consider this story from beginning to end and just state what the facts and records say and let readers make up their own mind about where this leaves Pius XII in the verdict of history.
And by the way, I'm reminded as I read your incredibly interesting narrative of the story, the work that Malcolm Muggeridge did when he discovered the atrocities of Stalin. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was one of the first to uncover that story to the West, and I think you have uncovered a story that isn't an uncovering an atrocity, but in a sense the correcting of an atrocity toward Pius XII. By the way, why do you spell his name out, Pius, and then the, T-H-E, and then 12th, rather than using the Roman numerals?
Well, I have this habit as a writer and this belief as a writer that basically all good prose reads well aloud. And especially now when Roman numerals have fallen into more or less disuse, to see them on the page, it makes a kind of dirtier page. But more to the point, when I spoke to people in the Vatican, such as Father Peter Gumpel, who's been managing this cause for Pius XII for 40 years,
right.
He always spoke of Pius XII. And that's the way, idiomatically, people in the Vatican speak of popes, almost like kings, because the pope is, in a sense, a king. So I just wanted it to read aloud on the
I liked it. It was easier on the eye, too. I don't like those old crusty Roman numerals.
Right.
They all look
right.
Like they belong on the bottom of pillars or something. But
exactly.
Now let's, I've been saying you won't believe the story, and let me just provide the broadest context for it. And I put on my personal Facebook page this morning, what you've outlined here is a intelligence network which was involved in bringing information from Nazi-controlled Germany and the various countries that it conquered to Pope Pius XII in his apartment. And in all these communications, he insisted that it be addressed to him and from him and not from the Vatican. He wanted to distinguish his work in this effort from the Vatican, so he would be personally responsible. And also the several different efforts, I think three, to try to actually assassinate him, to commit what you talk about as tyrannicide, which was resisted by the German Protestants, but pushed by the German Catholics. I think you have the phrase, Catholics trod where Protestants deferred, or something like that.
Feared to tread.
And it was. And also, you point out that Bonhoeffer, and when I went to Princeton Theological Seminary back in the 70s, Bonhoeffer was a great hero because he was the guy, the one minister of the word who tried to bring down Hitler. But you point out that Bonhoeffer was brought into this whole effort by Benedictines.
I guess he was, and he was lodged in this monastery called Ettal in the Bavarian Alps, a Bavarian monastery, and there he, if you read Bonhoeffer's letters, I forget which volume, in the 16-volume complete Bonhoeffer they are. But
not in the letters and papers, but in the complete.
Right, exactly. Letter. In the 16-volume one edition, you get in very granular detail his great pleasure at being so well-received by the clergy at the monastery, the brothers, how they were reading aloud from his work on ethics, which was mm-hmm. then in the process.
Which I read in seminary, by the way.
A very important work. And
yes.
he Bonhoeffer then makes two changes. One is he moves from passive and nonviolent resistance to active and violent resistance, at least in the form of conspiracy. And that's, many believe, and I believe, due to the direct influence of the Jesuits with whom he was in contact at this time, especially Father Rupert Mayer, a very famous Munich Jesuit who used to go to the Munich railway station and offer a quick mass so that people could take the sacraments before they went hiking in the Bavarian Alps on Sunday, which is a very Bavarian kind of thing. But he had a great influence, Father Mayer.
Aquinas as a source for their justification for tyrannicide, correct?
They were, and especially Aquinas as filtered through Jesuit theologians of the Counter-Reformation. And, there had been some controversy over this, and during the 19th century, when the Church was trying to project a different image to the world, one which secular powers were not so enthusiastic about attacking during the rise of nationalism, a lot of these interpretations had been sort of set aside, and Emmanuel saw Spanish Jesuit, his works on tyrannicide were even put on the index of prohibited books. But in 1901, Pope Leo XIII very quietly removed this Jesuit work on tyrannicide from the index, and that was just as Pacelli, Eugenio Pacelli of the future Pope Pius XII, joined the Vatican Foreign Service. So there was an updating, or at least a going back in certain ways to these old doctrines, which did, as you point out, prove very useful during the time where Protestants and Catholics had to come together and form a united front against Hitler, Bonhoeffer being probably the signal influence, or the signal case of this influence.
Tell our listeners, though, now Pacelli, who became Pius XII, had been nuncio in Germany, had been in Europe representing the Catholic Church for many, many years, ever since he was a young man. But tell us that moment, that fork in the road, when he was approached by the German resistance to become a player in this effort to assassinate Hitler.
Well, he was approached, as best we can determine from the documents, in the middle of October 1939. He probably made the decision on October 16th.
This was right after the Nazis invaded Poland.
After they invaded Poland, and they were preparing then to invade France, although it didn't happen until many months later, this was now in the stages of planning. And the German generals, who had really opposed the invasion of Poland, were now up in arms because they really didn't want a wider war. They wanted a negotiated truce with the West. And so they sent a very interesting lay Catholic agent who was very close to the Cardinal Archbishop of Munich, Michael Faulhaber. His name was Josef Müller.
And you call him Joe Ox, I believe, Joseph Ox?
His name was Joey Ox, or Daryl, because he
was, listen, he's the hero, next to Pius, he's the hero of the story.
He really is. He was an amazing guy. He was incredibly brave. Pius XII said that he worked wonders. He was, according to the Nazis themselves, the best agent of the Vatican Intelligence Service in Germany. And he would fly secrets of church secrets, reports of Nazi persecutions of the church. He would put them in a briefcase, and then he would get in a single-seat sports plane and fly over the Alps from Germany to Murano, Switzerland, where he would give the reports to a contact who would take them to Pius XII in Rome. So he was a natural conduit for Hitler's opponents, and he brought an offer from Hitler's opponents to the Pope on or about October 16th, 1939, saying, will you, Holy Father, serve as our foreign agent in contacts with the British to negotiate a peace or pre-existing peace terms so that when we remove Hitler and install a new government, we're sure that you won't take advantage of the chaos in Germany if there's a civil war.
So he became the guy who was going to assure the Germans who were involved in the assassination plot that they would be, that Germany would be treated fairly once Hitler was done away with.
That's right. And one of the reasons they trusted the Holy Father in this respect was, as you say, he had served in Germany for nearly a decade as a papal nuncio, actually for 12 years, first in Bavaria and then in Berlin. He knew some of these German generals from riding horses with them in Berlin on the estate of a mutual friend. So there's a phenomenon here which I call secret sacred social networks, where people, Catholics, or believing Christians in a situation of tyranny or dictatorship, have very trusted social connections, and the power of people informally then becomes much more important than a lot of formal structures, whether they be formal church structures or formal government structures. The idea that people behind the scenes acting on their own was very much something that Pius XII believed in, and the documents say this. So this was very much up his alley, and as you say, he wanted to take this burden upon himself. It's a radical assumption of responsibility, of moral and practical responsibility, where he said, I want this to be me and not the church. And there are various reasons for that, which I go into in the book. But one of them is that there was still a lot of anti-Catholicism, especially in British Protestants.
I noticed that their resistance to the messages being sent out from the Vatican, from the Pope, through intermediaries like Osborne.
That's right. And in the summer of 1939, where Pius was desperately trying to convene like a five-power peace conference, the British refused to participate, and I think it was the Archbishop of Westminster, the Anglican bishop, or people around him issued very sharp rebukes about Vatican meddling in politics. You know, and all the Pope was trying to do was convene a peace conference. So that tells you something about the different time we were in terms of ecumenism hadn't at all become respectable as it did after the war. And one of the
it's interesting, Mark, that you know in Germany those Nazis, and particularly Admiral, I think Canaris is his name.
Canaris,
who was more or less the center of the resistance in Berlin, they came to see Catholics as their only real ally in this effort.
Well, certainly that's true. And there's a quote from one of the Protestant conspirators, Moltke,
yes,
who says, you know, this is, he tells the Jesuit provincial of Munich, he says, I tell you this as a Protestant, that I believe that Christianity and freedom in Germany can only be saved through the intercession of the Pope.
That was one of the most amazing quotes in your book. I took so many quotes, I think I filled 20 pages from your book.
Well, I tried to only, you know, use primary sources, and I tried to keep to...
No, it's beautifully sourced. I must say that anybody who, you know, that, and I'm a stickler. I'm like you, a former editor. I'm a president editor. A stickler on, you know, citing sources, and you have something like 80 pages of notes at the end of your book.
Yeah, it's like a quarter or a third of the book. But
it's important here because there's going to be a lot of skeptics, right?
That's right, yeah.
Have you already started hearing from the skeptics?
Well, you know, I mean, I try not to pay too much attention to what the world says either way, you know, because, you know, if you believe the good stuff, you have to believe the bad stuff too, you know. So, you know, I try to just hew to my own way, but, you know, I'm certainly expecting to have a lot of people say, well, you know, this moves history in the wrong direction. This will make Catholics less reflective and less feeling in need of atonement for what happened.
Boy, I tell you, it did the opposite to me. Reading, I thought, boy, I'm a wimp. I need to get out there and make a difference.
I hope it's in.
Yeah, inspiring. I mean, it's a call to heroism. It's a call to living your faith.
Well,
that's what it is.
You know, the Vatican issued a collection of the speeches of Pius XI under the title of A Call to Heroism in 1941-1942. And, you know, a number of individual Catholics heeded this call. And I think it is accurate to say that this was more the struggle of individual Catholics than the church as an institution.
Well, except for the Jesuit order, and to some extent the Dominicans and the Benedictines, but the Jesuits in particular seem to be constantly at the forefront of your narrative. Is that correct?
That's true. And certainly within Germany, the most directly active church organization was certainly the Upper Bavarian province.
And of course, Hitler hated the Jesuits for that reason, correct?
Well, he did. I mean, there's a certain Jesuitophobia that was through Europe. And, you know, there are a lot of these myths and legends and black legends about the Jesuits. And so, for sure, the SS saw the Jesuits, their documents describe them as, you know, the Pope's stormtroopers and the fiercest Romish fighting force. And the truth is that the Jesuits, certainly the Munich Jesuits, proved themselves up to this. There were three Jesuits in particular and one lay coadjutor who really were deeply, deeply involved in the second and third of the major plots to assassinate Hitler. They, at one point, even pilfered the blueprints to one of Hitler's bunkers and provided these blueprints to the assassination planners who were hoping to get in through the vents and shafts and maybe put, you know, some kind of, I'll let readers discover that themselves. But they were actually very operationally involved. They dressed in disguise. They rode the trains at night.
Well, they pretended to be, they would hang out with women and pretend to be lovers on the at the train station, I believe.
Right. They would promenade so that the SS would.
I mean, this has got to be a movie. I hope somebody's coming to you and offering you a lot of money for the film rights.
Well, I hope that proves me the case. Certainly, it's got a strong line of some.
Oh, it's a great narrative. Listen, I want to tell our listeners, this entire book reads like a novel. It reads like a spy thriller, and I mean that as praise because it's hard to put down. The way you begin a chapter and end a chapter, you just have to press on. And but one thing I want to establish, though, Mark, and I'm talking to Mark Riebling about his wonderful new book from Basic Books entitled Church of Spies, The Pope's Secret War Against Hitler. And by the way, those of you who like audiobooks, it's just made available on Audible. I love audiobooks myself, so I was glad to see it there.
Thank you.
Explain why he was silent. In other words, you note that in 1939 was the last time he used the word Jew until the end of the war.
In public.
And I think that is probably the one thing that people need to understand. Could you sort of explain that? Because you constantly come back to that in the book.
Well, it is the sort of great mystery of the church during the war, and the simple answer is that he was advised by the church in Germany, by its leaders, as early as March 1939, during the first week after Pius was elected Pope. He received four German cardinals, and they were sitting down in the Vatican to plot the strategy which they would pursue toward Hitler and the Nazis under Pius XII's brand new pontificate. And the transcripts of these audiences, which we have due to the fact that Jesuit technicians bugged the meeting and made transcripts of it, they say very clearly that the German episcopate asked Pius XII not to speak out because they believed this would put German Catholics in a very difficult position, and that what might happen was that German Catholics would see themselves more as Germans than as Catholics and would side with Hitler and the forces of the nation.
It would cause a schism.
And cause a schism, and that the church would break away, as it did under Henry VIII in England and other places, even more recently, such as the Czech Republic, which had broken away and formed a Czech national church in the 20s. So Pius XII, exactly the opposite to how he's been portrayed by some, especially John Cornwell, as this arch-centralizer who's imposing Rome's will on these recalcitrant local bishops and Catholics, instead pursues the opposite approach.
He didn't want it. He resisted it. That's not the way he wanted to go. I mean, after all, he had been the author of Mit Breniger Sorge under his predecessor, right?
That's right, and he had authored very fierce and sharp words against the Nazi regime, although he didn't use the word Nazi. It was clear whom he meant. But after the German Catholics had to live with the resulting persecutions for a couple of years, after Pius XI had spoken out in 1937, they asked Pius XII in these March 1939 meetings to ease up. They said, "We need relief. It's gone from 90% of Catholics being in parochial schools to 4% or something like that."
And you point out that this was corroborated when the Dutch bishops issued a pastoral letter that led to the death of 40,000 Jews.
There was certainly a fear that any papal pronouncement would lead to an intensification of the persecutions, and Hitler himself had warned that this would happen in his speech on January 30th, 1939, to the Reichstag, where he said, "Any foreign powers who think that by protesting what they claim are unjust methods will only find an intensification of those methods if they persist in trying to humiliate us." And I think it was pretty much known by that time, especially after Kristallnacht, that Hitler was going to be a man of his word.
But tell our listeners in the next 2 minutes before our break what happened in Poland to Catholic priests, and it was a deliberate effort on Hitler to stamp out the church.
Well, as soon as they invaded in September 1939, they began a vicious effort led by the SS to destroy any structures of Polish society which could provide resistance to Nazi rule. And in Poland, the SS decided that the main structure was the Catholic Church and individual clerics. And they did something very vicious, which was instead of going after the bishops, usually they'd go after lower clergy, and they'd put the bishops in a very difficult position, whereas if they did anything, the lives of those under them were essentially hostage. And, you know, they shot several hundred priests in the first weeks of occupation and shipped most of the rest off to the concentration camp at Dachau. And, you know, as a result, the Polish church really felt that it was left to extinction. And the first cries of criticism against Pius XII were not from Jewish organizations, but they were from Polish Catholics who accused the Pope of being silent on what was happening to them, these atrocities against Catholics. And the truth is that with the exception of some remarks on Vatican radio, the Pope did refrain from publicly protesting the atrocities against Catholics in Poland. He opted, on the advice of German bishops and even some Polish bishops, to try to work behind the scenes to relieve...
To avoid further death.
To avoid further death, and also to try and deal with the root cause. And by the way, in the United States, the Roosevelt administration pursued, in some ways, a parallel attack, and that they didn't want to portray the war as a struggle to defend European Jewry, and so they very much minimized talk about the Shoah and the Jewish victims, because they didn't want to give ammunition to the isolationists. They wanted to portray it as a crusade for Christian civilization. And so there were many pressures from many different sides about how you were going to sell the war, just as we saw even with the Iraq War.
Now, Mark, we're going to come back to this. I'm talking to Mark Riebling about his wonderful new book, Church of Spies, The Pope's Secret War Against Hitler. We're going to talk about the actual attempts to assassinate Hitler that Pope Pius XII knew of and approved after this short message.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Cultural Madness and Catholic Sanity, How to Live in Love Without Illusion in This New America. That's the title for our October 17th conference in Dearborn, Michigan. America is adrift on some rough seas, and Catholic truth is supposed to be a lighthouse. Complacent, self-identified Catholics, however, have hid Christ's light under a bushel. And so the people are walking in darkness and imagining that it's fantasy. Americans are making up reality as we go along. We've made up a new definition of marriage. Some parents refuse to assign a gender to their newborns. Let the child make it up as he goes along. President Obama denies that we're in a religious war with Islamic jihadists, but saying so doesn't make it so. Contraception activists have long promised liberation. They don't look at reality. We're a culture of single-parent families, epidemic STDs, gender confusion, and a 50% out-of-wedlock birth rate. Hey, Planned Parenthood can now monetize aborted babies, and young girls get applause for being hot rather than for being smart. What about men? They're making up romance during pornographic laptop dances. We're amusing ourselves to death and surrounded by perpetual entertainment, extravagant advertising promises, and false gospels are assuring us that we can both revere God and be God. It's an imaginary social world disconnected from the real world God created. So how do we live in love without illusion in this age of cultural madness? Learn how Saturday, October 17th at the Ford Motor Company Conference Center in Dearborn, Michigan. Teresa Tomeo and I will be talking about Islam, porn, advertising, body image, news media, and more. It's all day with lunch included, but seats are limited. Saturday, October 17th. Learn more at AveMariaRadio.net. That again is AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm back with Mark Riebling. We're talking about his remarkable new book from Basic Books about Pius XII and his active role in plotting against Hitler is actual death. The title of the book is Church of Spies, The Pope's Secret War Against Hitler. Mark, could you walk us through these various attempts to assassinate Hitler that the pontiff knew about and approved of in advance, and how they failed?
Well, the first attempt, which was really motivated by the German military's opposition to Hitler's planned invasion of the West, ran from October 1939 to May 1940. And during this plot, the Pope served as an intermediary between Hitler's would-be assassins in Germany and the British government under Neville Chamberlain in London. And the thing sort of came to a climax around February 1940 when the Pope held midnight meetings in the papal apartments with Sir Darcy Osborne, who was the British ambassador to the Holy See, and really went to the mat for the German conspirators, expressing his total confidence in their ability to get rid of Hitler and in the fact that they would set up something which was not a dictatorship after Hitler had died.
Mm-hmm.
This was very important. London took it very seriously. There was a series of war cabinet meetings about what the Pope had put on offer. The British agreed to negotiate peace terms in advance so that the German generals would have some motivation to get rid of Hitler. And the climax of these negotiations, which are some call the Roman conversations, was something called the X Report, which was written down on pieces of, like, basically toilet paper, which the intermediary, Josef Müller, could swallow if he was captured. He brought them back to Germany after about five or seven rounds of negotiation. And they were typed up in a spare bedroom that was used by Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Berlin. And peace terms were presented to the German generals in April 1940, and they decided not to act for reasons basically pertaining to cowardice and personal timidity. It went to the very top of the German military, and they just thought, well, if we do this, the people won't follow us. They're too loyal to Hitler. He had just invaded Norway at that time and achieved yet another glorious victory.
Right.
And so the German generals lost their nerve. But in the wake of this, Pius XII did something that's truly extraordinary, and which I do talk about in my book as well. He then proceeded to warn the Western powers in great detail about the exact time and place of the German invasion of France and the Low Countries.
And they didn't believe him.
They didn't believe the warnings, but subsequently the Pope had a lot of credibility, and Vatican intelligence capabilities had a lot of credibility because the Pope's warnings had proved so accurate, really down to the kind of troops which would be used to take certain bridges and so forth. And this information was provided by the German conspirators as a way of trying to show that even though they didn't bring off Hitler's death, they were reliable and they could be counted on in a hoped-for second round of plots against Hitler, which did eventually materialize after Hitler had invaded Russia in 1941. And it became apparent by the end of 1941 that he was not going to capture Moscow by the end of the year, as had seemed very, very likely in the summer. And so when this happened, the German high command and a much more broad way realized that the war was lost. And so the second round of plots came into being. And in this second round of plots, the German Jesuits, especially the Munich Jesuits, became very deeply operationally
involved. Yeah, they really stepped up to the plate at this point.
They really did, and they became the runners or couriers between various German officers stationed throughout Germany who had troops that they could use in a coup. And they also engaged very deeply in the planning for the post-Hitler, post-war political order, down to the point where
a democratic Christian republic made up of small communities, I believe.
Yes, they definitely looked to sort of a small, I think there was a phrase, the largest possible number of the smallest possible communities.
Yeah, which, by the way, went back to Jacques Maritain's idea of the little platoons that he talked about when he was a Vatican ambassador to the Vatican.
Very much so, and in some ways it reminds me of what we have even today with people talking about growing local and being sustainable.
Right. Well,
trying to.
Maritain loves Saul Alinsky. I hate to mention that on air, but he did.
That's okay. I mean, look, let a thousand flowers bloom, but certainly these flowers bloomed in the you know, the shadow of the swastika. And one of the things that the Jesuits did was to write an intended German post-war constitution based on the United States Federalist Papers, of which they were students. And from these secret political plans did come eventually something that which is very close to the Christian social democracy, which ended up dominating European post-war politics in a number of countries. So that was a unique contribution which emerged from the second plots. But the second round of plots against Hitler in which the Pope was involved came to a head in March 1943. And at this time, the Pope had again gone as a secret foreign agent of the resistance to the English and had again negotiated informally an understanding that the Allies would not take advantage of disorder in Germany after Hitler's death. But unfortunately, the plot failed because when a time bomb was put on Hitler's plane, it froze at high altitude, maybe because the plane climbed to avoid flak. And at this higher altitude, the fuse froze, and Hitler landed safely. At this point, the plotters felt that they had to explain the failure of the plot personally to the Pope, so they decided to send Josef Müller and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Protestant resistant figure, clergyman, pastor, to Rome to try to keep things alive. But, however, just at this juncture, the SS swooped in and arrested Josef Müller, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and several other key conspirators. Basically, they beheaded the German opposition in one move. They put these people in jail and began to interrogate them. And the great fear arose in the Vatican, especially among the Pope's Jesuit advisors, that Pius XII would be directly implicated in the plotting. And it was touch and go for a while. No one knew who had talked, who had said what, how much they'd implicated the Holy Father. And so a lot of papers and things, anything possibly incriminating was, well, it became smoke that rose from German, Roman chimneys at this time. And so it was only through the efforts of one individual Catholic, Klaus Schenk von Stauffenberg, colonel in the German army, that the third round of plots against Hitler came together. And that then became a quite exciting chain of
events. And that's the one that most people know about.
That's the one about which Tom Cruise movie was made, called Valkyrie, which didn't focus on the Catholic elements of the opposition, but for Stauffenberg, you know, this is a guy who really had, you know, what I would call a stained glass mind. He looked very directly to the United Christendom of the Middle Ages and the time of Charlemagne and their following as a sort of lost ideal of the West. And there was a broader movement among German intellectuals to go back to the Middle Ages, to Christendom. It was called the Reichsgedanken, and it was a sort of rethinking of the idea of empire, the idea of a Holy Roman Empire. Which could replace the Third Reich. And this idea of a united Europe, a Europe united in Christian ideals, could provide a sort of counter-myth to the Nazi myth, which had so many people, and even, tragically, so many Christians under its spell.
Is it fair to say that none of this would have happened had it not been for the explicit support of Pius XII?
Well, I that may be going too far, but it certainly would not have reached the levels of intensity and credibility that it did without the support of the Holy Father. In other words, I would not say that he was either a necessary or sufficient condition, and used strictly logically, I believe there would have been plots. But he was really key in joining the foreign and domestic parts of the conspiracy. And it's a pretty radical thing if you think about it. I mean, if, let's say there were people in Russia and they wanted to get rid of Putin, and they went to Pope Francis and they said, will you go between us and Obama? I mean, it's not a footnote to history. That's a very radical thing.
Right.
And you can imagine if you're someone in the Ukraine or in Moscow and you realize Pope Francis has, he's one of us, you can imagine the galvanizing effect of how that would have on morale. And morale is extremely important in these kinds of things where you're really risking your life and perhaps your family's lives. So while it's a difficult thing to quantify logically, the testimony from the people who were involved was that it really did give a real shoot of moral juice or adrenaline to the plotting as it went forward.
You described several other plots to kill Hitler, including one in Prague. Well, actually, I want to talk a little bit about that, the successful killing of a Nazi general spy leader, the one who was closest to uncovering the Vatican involvement. You talk about, his name is Heydrich, I believe.
Yeah, Reinhard Heydrich.
And the Czech resistance successfully assassinated him, and then they fled, I think there were seven, into the cathedral at Prague where they were hiding. But they extracted from a Czech the whereabouts of them by showing him the head of his mother floating in a fish tank.
It's quite macabre, yes, and these were truly evil people who would really stop at nothing to intimidate their enemies. And the whole episode of the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, who was not only the SS spy chief and not only the leader of the war against political Catholicism, but he was also the architect and a real executor of the Final Solution, the genocide of the Jews.
I didn't know that. I missed that.
Yeah, his assassination was probably the single most successful covert operation in a guerrilla sense of the Second World War. Really spectacular. He was gunned down at a hairpin turn in Czechoslovakia when his driver had to brake to slow down to make the turn. He was killed by a grenade that was thrown under his car. But what was interesting to me about this was not only that the assassins had received shelter in the cathedral of Prague, and that there was a very dramatic shootout within the cathedral, you know, with the machine guns being, you know, aimed down from the choir loft and so on and so forth, and then a shootout in the crypt, but that there was a pretty serious trail of Jesuits who were subsequently arrested, interrogated, and suspected for providing the support network used by the Czechs. And, you know, a lot of that I put in a footnote of in the book because I didn't want to digress the main narrative. But it's quite interesting because Josef Müller, who I've been talking about and who's really the hero of this book, he had a lot of Jesuit connections in Prague and in Bratislava or Pressburg, the Slovakian part of the former Czechoslovakia.
I'm glad you brought us back to Josef Müller. Tell that story, if you can, in, you know, next few minutes.
Well, Josef Müller, Joey Ox, was the ace of papal spies. And although he was, you know, a mild-mannered sort of book publisher who puffed a pipe and collected stamps, he was one of the most courageous people you can imagine. He was an ordinary man put in an extraordinary situation, and he ended up being led to the gallows in April 1945. But before that, he served as the intermediary between Pius and the plotters for, about, you know, 4 years.
He made hundreds of trips to the Vatican out of Germany.
He made hundreds of trips, and he did so under the cover of German military intelligence, where he was, the official story was that he was going to spy on the Vatican, but he was really kind of a double agent. He used his military cover to actually work for the German resistance and for what amounted to a kind of de facto papal intelligence service.
It's amazing that Himmler let him go when he brought him in.
Well, he was Joseph Mueller was arrested very early in the Reich in February 1934 because he was involved in efforts to expose what was going on at the first concentration camp that the SS had set up at Dachau. And this, he actually was able to get the first commandant of the camp fired for murdering Jews. And the Nazis didn't like this. They didn't like being embarrassed. So they called in Joseph Mueller and they interrogated him, and Himmler himself led the interrogation. And at one point, they asked Mueller, well, what were you doing when we took over in Bavaria? What did you do to resist this? And he answered quite honestly. He said, well, I urged the then Bavarian prime minister to have you put up against the wall and shot. Now, no one spoke to the Nazis this way, and they were so floored by someone who wasn't cringing that they thought, well, this is a manly sort of person. This is a person who should be in the SS.
And right.
They tried to recruit him, and he said, well, nothing doing. I'm a Catholic. You know, I couldn't
possibly. I'm a Catholic first, right.
So Himmler was just astounded. He didn't know what to do. He's flummoxed, so he let Mueller go, but he obviously ordered him to be watched. And the SS actually was convinced, absolutely convinced, and they couldn't be talked out of it, that Mueller was secretly a Jesuit who had been given a special dispensation by the Pope to marry and have children. And as evidence of this, they cited that he'd been married at the tomb of St. Peter beneath the Vatican, beneath the high altar of St. Peter's in Rome. And well, he was married there, but he, as far as we know, certainly was not a secret Jesuit. But this goes back to the ideas which people had, crazy ideas about what the Jesuits did in Europe then. But in the end, Mueller was arrested, as I said, in April 1943.
How was he caught? Tell us that.
Well, he was caught because there was something that the German resistance and the Catholics in the German resistance got involved in, an operation called U-7, codenamed U-7, which was a rat line or a smuggling route used to exfiltrate Jews from Germany and from occupied Europe. And it was kind of an underground railroad using monasteries and convents and so on and so forth. And it wasn't a large-scale operation, but people who had Jews who had friends in the German military used those connections to try and get themselves or their parents or whoever out in time. And Josef Mueller was involved in securing money and in false papers for a number of these Jews, as was Father Alfred Delp, a Jesuit, and some others in the
Another hero of your story, by the way.
Right, exactly. And unfortunately, in Josef Mueller's case, the Czech, the Prague end of this underground railroad was exposed because someone was trying to make money on the side by fencing some jewels and got arrested at the railroad station, and the Gestapo started pulling on this thread, and eventually it led back to the German military conspirators, and they were all arrested.
Now, why was it Mueller killed?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, some people speculated, you know, at the time in British intelligence, they said, well, how come Mueller wasn't immediately killed? And, you know, why was he left alone?
Because his handlers were executed.
Some of them were, and in fact, most of the people involved in what the Gestapo codenamed the Black Chapel, the Vatican-linked resistance, were hanged. And in the end, Mueller was saved, and I don't want to give too many spoilers here for those who read the book.
But, right. Well, there's plenty left, I'll tell you.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Mueller was fortunate because he had a best friend or a very close friend, beer buddy, who happened to be the head of Hitler's bodyguard in charge of protecting Hitler. And this fellow, Hans Rottenhuber, had always admired the way Mueller stood up to Himmler and admitted that he would, under direct interrogation, that he would have had Himmler shot. And Rattenhuber had been sort of a guardian angel over Mueller, and in that respect would warn Mueller of what he'd heard within, you know, the gossip within the SS. They're going to do this to you. They're going to raid this church. They're going to do this thing. And so that really helped Mueller keep one step ahead. And sometimes during his interrogations, he was better informed about the matter at hand than the people interrogating him. He was also very wily, crafty. He was really the Odysseus of the German resistance. You know, he was full of so many tricks, and he was very good at jujitsu, not only when the guards, you know, unshackled him so he could go to the bathroom, he'd throw them using jujitsu, but he'd use verbal jujitsu. He'd use people's biases against them. In one case, when they decided to say, well, was it true that you interned for a Jewish lawyer when you were just a young lawyer? And he said, oh, well, they're interested in that. Let me play that up. And so he would talk about how much he liked Jews and how great this Jewish lawyer was in order to provoke the wrath of his interrogators, and they'd lose the train of what they were really supposed to be interrogating him about. So Mueller was very good at psychology, and the SS, their records are full of remarks about how he's this unusually intrepid man of the Jesuit school, and he's extremely crafty. So I think a lot of it was his character, but in the end, it was his willingness to stand up for who he really was and speak the truth to power, as it were, to Himmler, which ended up being his sort of the Ariadne thread which he was able to follow to get out of this labyrinth, because at the end of the Reich, when Mueller was led to the gallows, at that moment, his buddy Hans Rotenhuber, the head of Hitler's bodyguard, was intervening to try and save him, because he so admired Mueller for being willing to stand up to Himmler. And so in the end, this is a case of, a man who won his life because he was willing to lose it.
Wonderful. Now, I'm talking with Mark Riebling about his new book, Church of Spies, The Pope's Secret War Against Hitler, which I'm calling a must-read for all Catholics. I can't speak to everybody else, but I hope I can speak to them. And it reads beautifully. It's beautifully written, and it tells a story that we haven't heard. The last few minutes, Mark, how do you hope your book will impact the reputation of Pius XII?
Well, that's a really great question. I'd certainly like for people to think of Pius XII not as Hitler's pope, but as a pope who fought Hitler in a way which ultimately was not successful, but which was motivated by truly courageous impulses and really humanitarian impulses. He wanted peace, and he wanted peace for the whole world, and was really willing to do something brave. And, because he was involved not only in plots to eliminate Hitler, but was involved in the successful overthrow of Mussolini, the Nazis did have for a time a plan to kidnap him, which did not end up going through, but which was a real plan for a while in the latter part of 1943. And Himmler even fantasized about capturing Pius XII and bringing him to Berlin and having him publicly executed to celebrate the opening of a new soccer stadium. So this is an important part of this pope and his controversial legacy. And, I know that there's an issue in terms of whether or not or when Pius XII will be made a saint. I try to stay out of these debates, which are really for the people in the Vatican who are involved with these things to decide upon, sort of in the same way that the Baseball Hall of Fame has to decide whether or not they're going to put Pete Rose in. You can have your opinion right as a fan, but it's really the responsibility of the people in the organization. I do think it's important for our Jewish brethren to understand that the description Hitler's pope is really scandalously false, and it's even false for those who would read John Cornwell's book, Hitler's Pope. Church of Spies is, I think, an important corrective and really does position Pius XII where he belongs. He belongs, really, he's much more Churchill's pope and Roosevelt's pope than he was Hitler's pope. But he was really the pope of those who wanted a sort of an example and really inspiration and assistance in trying to do something which would actually have gone to the root of the problem. And frankly, if Pius XII had been arrested and executed for his role in the plots, as, say, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was, we wouldn't ever have considered calling him Hitler's pope. And so, whether the plot succeeded or failed was not the fault of Pius XII. And so we shouldn't evaluate him for the success or failure of something which didn't depend on him personally. We should only evaluate him for what he actually did do. And I think in that light, history over time will take a much kinder, warmer, and more sensible view of this very controversial pope.
Well, Mark Riebling, I want to thank you for being on Church and Culture, and I really want to thank you for writing your wonderful book, Church of Spies, because I think it's also a call to heroism for all Catholics and for all Christians in the face of evil, in the face of death. I know I felt it. It had a great impact on me. And I ask all of our listeners to take a look. Mark Riebling, Church of Spies. It's on Amazon. It's everywhere. It's on audiobook. And, Mark, I hope that when the dust settles over your book that you can come back on the show. We can talk some more.
I'd love to. It's been a great honor and pleasure. Thank you so much, Dale.
Thank you, Mark. And to all of you who are listening, please hang around. After this short message, I'll be back with another guest.
Come and see us at Old St. Mary's Greektown for our 12th annual homecoming Sunday, October 4th. Following the noon mass, there will be outdoor refreshments, food, and fellowship. We welcome past and present parishioners and anyone who wants to see this historic downtown church. Whether you visited us before or are just interested in looking for a future parish, it's a great time to meet with parishioners and discover Old St. Mary's. More information is available on our website at oldstmarys.com.
Ever wonder why social networking is such a popular internet exercise? We humans are hardwired for society. It's in our DNA. The human person needs to live in society, the Catholic Catechism tells us. It is a requirement of man's nature. There is a certain resemblance between the unity of the three divine persons and the fraternity that humans are to establish among themselves in truth and love. As Jesus made clear, love of God is inseparable from love of neighbor. Humanity's vocation, says the Catechism, is to show forth the image of God and be transformed into the image of the Father's only Son, Jesus. It is through mutual service and dialogue with one another that we develop our potential and thus respond to the end to which we are called, God Himself. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
What are some of your favorite memories from homeschooling? For HSLDA blogger Julie Schnatterly, reading together with her kids is at the top of the list. Discover the benefits of reading aloud on today's Homeschool Heartbeat with your host, Mike Smith.
My guest this week is Julie Schnatterly. She's a grant administrator for the Homeschool Foundation and a guest writer on HSLDA's blog and a homeschooling mom. Julie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mr. Smith. Thank you for having me.
Well, Julie, back in May, you wrote a blog post about the importance of family reading time. Now, what inspired you to write that?
Well, reading together with my children and sharing books and engrossing ourselves in a story together is one of the best memories that I have of homeschooling my children, who are all young adults now.
Well, why do you think it's so important for parents to read together with their children?
It creates a shared experience. So we meet characters in books and go places together, and we make memories. And we developed, through that experience, this language of common knowledge that became a part of our family culture. So even though the children are older, we still have references to books or stories or people that we met, and it's kind of woven into that fabric of our family.
Can you give us a little example of how this actually worked?
We would take just a quiet time, maybe an hour after lunch or when the kids weren't too old to take a nap and they just needed some quiet time to settle and just sit and read together. We would read in the evening, at the park, wherever it just seemed to be a good place where we could just sit together and read stories.
Well, thank you, Julie. That's very encouraging. Until next time, I'm Mike Smith.
Today's program was part of a longer interview. If you'd like to hear the whole thing, you can find it on our website at homeschoolheartbeat.com. That's homeschoolheartbeat.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Ave Maria Radio's upcoming conference, Cultural Madness and Catholic Sanity, is not just about the state of the world, but about the state of our souls.